was dealing with open addressing, where we wanted to not store a linked list, because usually we learned that the linked list was very short, and if we had small keys, this would be worthwhile. We also talked a bit about cryptographic hashes, so where we had a different goal for our hash function. We had these security properties we wanted to hold, not something we'll use for hash tables, but something you'll come across in the real world, because we want to do things like verify downloads. And then we started briefly talking about assembly and machine code. So assembly is our form, our text form that we get before we get to what the machine understands. And it's closer to what our machine's actually going to deal with. So we have this example of very opaque assembly here. And when you compile something, that's something that's generated, yes.
Oh,
yeah. Okay, that's probably better. Sorry, I started late because I was having stupid technical difficulties in my slides. That flusters me that way. So now that, and that's what becomes a .o file, and you've seen sort of .o files when you made a make file. And that ultimately becomes an executable when we combine it with things like the standard library, because something needs to implement cout. And that gets turned into bytes that the machine actually understands. And the way the machine actually works is that it, you know, has some place it needs to look for work, it reads some bytes, it finds that work. So we call machine language what the physical hardware is expecting, so how it reads the bytes when it's looking at the memory to look for work. And assembly language is a text representation of that. So assembly language has some things that machine language doesn't. So for example, we have names like sub for subtract, or MOV for move. So we have operation names, whereas in our machine code, obviously it's a number we have to figure out how it's interpreted. We also have names which I'm going to call labels, like this. So this seems like just some random string that represents cout. That's why it contains cout in its last characters. But we have these names which are more interpretable, but ultimately they need to get turned into numbers. And those numbers basically are going to be something like memory addresses. So our assembly language has a very direct translation, but it has some useful features to make it easier to understand. So in addition to splitting it up into its pieces, rather than just being a bunch of numbers, which we have to interpret more, it gives us like names for the operations and names for values we're referring to elsewhere, like things that have an address somewhere in our computer. And the reason we care about this, you know, depends, you know, if you obviously want to design hardware or actually produce assembly and your job, you'll care about it. But even if you don't, we think it's useful for you to know because, well, you're going to have programs that ultimately are using machine language and something will go wrong, and we'd like you to be able to, if necessary, figure out what's going wrong by looking at the assembly if it comes to that. So let's talk about what our machines look like. So we've kind of glossed over components of the machines. We talked a bit about memory. This is a thing you're familiar with. So we say that memory is basically an array of bytes or something like that. So we have a bunch of addresses, and each of those addresses have a value. So memory in our typical processors is our slower storage. So we have a bunch of circuits that actually do our calculation, and memory talks to those. We also have registers. So registers are this small, fast storage, typically like they're less than like a kilobyte or so, it varies, but they're not going to be very large, and they're not part of memory. They do not have an address. They have names, like I'm showing you here, and maybe we can number them, but they don't have an address in the sense that they're not part of memory. You can't make a pointer to a register because when you have a pointer, it's going to look over here for that value. It's not going to ever find any of these values in registers. And on a typical machine, it varies between different architectures. You'll have about 4 to say 32 normal registers accessible in assembly. And there might be some additional registers which are used internally by the machine, but that you can't easily access directly in assembly, but are used for some important tasks. And we'll talk about a couple of them in a second. So our calculating circuits in our processor have access to these registers, and that's generally faster. And usually the registers are going to be on, you know, very, very close to the circuits that calculate. That's one of the reasons why they're faster. Whereas our memory is usually on a physically separate piece of hardware. That's, you can like separate and reattach. But our memory is the only place where you can store big amounts of data. So this is where we're going to put our programs. So we won't have enough space to put a useful program in our registers, so it's going to be in memory. This is where we're going to put most of our data. So while we're calculating on data, we'll often put it in registers, but we only have a kilobyte, and that has to deal with not just like our actual data, but like loop indices, any temporary values you're computing. Those all need to fit there. Like, we can quickly run out of space, so we'll be using memory a lot more. And this is why, sort of in C, the notion you have is that, well, you can take a pointer to everything, so everything must be in memory. And sort of the assumption in C is that usually the compiler is going to store things in memory. We'll learn that when we look at actual assembly generated by compilers, that the compiler will try to use registers, but it won't always be able to because the registers are pretty small. And we also, of course, have other devices. Our computer would not be very useful if it only had a memory and a processor, and, you know, and then you, no keyboard attachments, no monitor. So there's some other devices which are attached there. We will mostly in this class not be talking about how that works. We'll be sort of assuming we have some instructions which somehow communicate with those other devices. But obviously that's an important part. You wouldn't consider a computer very useful without that. So we're going to have some special registers we care about. So one of these is something we're going to call the PC, or the program counter. So the PC contains the current code address. So it says, what is the machine code we are executing right now? So in this example, it contains address 2. And that means that we're reading some machine code starting at address 2. So you might also sometimes see the name IP for instruction pointer. Those both mean the same thing. We'll also have something we'll call the IR, or the instruction register, which contains a copy of the current instruction. So this is the value in memory loaded from the PC, and the processor would load this into a register because it wants to access it quickly while it's running the instruction itself. And so our basic execution of instruction is going to be something like this. We're going to load into the instruction register memory at the PC. We're going to interpret that register in some way. So we'll tell you about what rules could we have for what we interpret that as. But we'll interpret it as some sort of simple operation. And if it didn't change the PC, we'll add to the PC to go to the next instruction. If it did, like it's implementing a loop, we'll do something else. So our PC is our program counter. And our instruction register is this temporary storage that generally we won't be able to like access directly from assembly or as a machine code programmer, but that the processor uses to implement this instruction. And so the processor is only notably dealing with the bits of the instruction because this instruction register contains some bit representation. But for our first few examples, we'll be looking at not bits. So let's go through some example instructions. So in x86, here are some instructions. So just very, very simple instructions. So there's an add instruction. So for example, we can write in assembly, add ECX, EBX. ECX and EBX are the names of registers. You might be saying, who chose these horrible names? We'll talk a bit about that when we get to x86, but indeed they are not good names, but that's what were chosen. And we also have here add ECX1, which adds the constant one to ECX. So x86 instructions are pretty fancy because we can have multiple kinds of arguments with them and specify all these different registers. And what this first instruction does is, this is ECX equals ECX plus EBX. And the second one is ECX equals ECX plus 1. So we'll be starting off with a toy assembly language and machine language called IBCM. And these are some example IBCM instructions. So we have load 100. You might say, OK, you're loading 100 where? That's a good question. So all these instructions in IBCM implicitly act on a single register called the accumulator. So to make things really, really simple, why it's a toy language, we have one register for that the assembly language can access, and that's the accumulator register. So this load operation says the accumulator becomes memory at address 100. So this loads address 100 from memory and stores it in the accumulator register. This, you might say, so this add instruction adds something to the accumulator. In particular, it says it takes the accumulator and adds the value in memory at address 200. Note that that's not the value 200, but the value in memory at the address 200. So in IBCM, most of these instructions actually access the accumulator and someplace in memory. And store 300 does the opposite of load. So it writes into memory address 300 the value in the accumulator. So these are obviously different ways as far as if you're writing programs, but these are all simple operations that are going to be relatively easy for hardware to implement. If you were like writing a simulator for this, which we won't have you do, but would not be hard, like these are all things which are very quick to implement, all these instructions. And because we don't have things like loops here, we can all represent these as some fixed length thing pretty easily, which is not something we could say of like a general like C or Python program. Like there, you imagine a single line of code. That's not something where you can say, here's a fixed length storage, I'm gonna fit a single line of code in it. But with this, it's pretty easy to come up with a way, and we'll give an example for IBCM, where we can fit all the possible simple operations in some small amount of space, and therefore write something which handles all of them, and have that instruction register work, which is going to be important to make our hardware practical to implement. So IBCM, our toy assembly language, has no physical implementation. So with x86, we could tell you, hey, you have a VM, just compile and assemble this stuff into an executable and run it. Can't really do that for IBCM. So we have some simulators we provided, which work in a browser. If you go to the lab when we do IBCM, there are some other options. The browser simulators, I note, apparently do bad things if your program it doesn't terminate because they run JavaScript that keeps going forever, and therefore your web browser doesn't ever let you do things on the web page. So make sure your programs halt. There's an instruction in IBCM to halt, which conceptually means turn off the simulated machine. Okay. So since we're dealing with IBCM, let's talk about our IBCM state. So I told you we have one implicit register that all the assembly operations deal with, and we also have those two other registers we care about. And I mislabeled one of these. Should be the program counter. We have our program counter, our instruction register, and our accumulator. And we also have a memory. Our memory, kind of unlike the one you've been dealing with in C, is a memory with 16-bit values at each address. So each address doesn't represent a byte, it represents a 16-bit value. And we're going to call these 16-bit values words. And the memory is pretty small, so it contains 4,096, that's 2 to the 12 words, which means our addresses are 12 bits. You notice that this has the convenient property that we can fit an entire address and some other information in a 16-bit value. And we're going to take advantage of that when we choose our machine code format. Because our machine code for this, if you remember my instructions, I had like load 100, I put an address 100 in that instruction. And it's going to be really convenient that that address 100 and some other stuff, like is this is a load, is going to fit in 16 bits. But obviously, like this machine is enough to like do real calculations, but obviously it's pretty constrained to make this easy to reason about for your assignments. So any questions on this? Okay, so I'd like to talk a bit about words. So we're gonna deal with 16-bit values all the time, and we're calling that a word because it's the natural size of the machine. So all our registers here are 16 bits or 12 bits. The 12-bit register is the program counter because that's a memory address. Like, we could store an extra 4 bits, but probably shouldn't. Memory accesses are all 16 bits. Our accumulator is 16 bits. You know, all our calculations are done with 16 bits. Like, when we have the add instruction, it doesn't add two 32-bit values and then store them in a 16-bit register. Everything happens with 16 bits. And generally, for any machine, we call the natural size in which the machine acts a word. And this means that what a word is varies between machines. So if you have a machine where pointers are 32 bits and registers are 32 bits, you'll often say that that a word in that machine is 32 bits. And you'll see this sometimes. x86 is a bit weird because of the history. So in x86, you will find people who say a word is 16 bits. You will find people who say a word is 32 bits. You will find people who say a word is 64 bits. Because they all have different ideas about what part sizes on x86 are the natural size. Because x86, you know, has 32-bit things and 64-bit things, depending on what you're doing. Okay. So now we know about words, let's talk about our instructions. And IBCM, to keep things simple, we've chosen to make every instruction take up exactly one word. So we didn't have to do this. We could have imagined making our instruction register bigger and like fetching multiple words, but we're going to make things as simple as possible. So we're going to fetch the minimum amount we can get from memory, which is this one 16-bit word. And our instructions are going to use their most significant bits. So which I write leftmost on the slide. For something we call the opcode, which represents what operation, it's the code for the operation, does this instruction represent. So which instruction is it? So it doesn't tell us everything about the instruction, but it tells us what category of instruction it is. So for example, all our halt instructions have an opcode of 0. Anything with an opcode of 0 is a halt. In this case, there's not multiple kinds of halts, so the rest of the instruction just doesn't matter. All our instructions with an opcode of 1 are some sort of I.O. So all the I.O. instructions are put together, and when we're interpreting an instruction, we're going to look at this opcode first, and then we're going to do very different things depending on what the opcode is. So the first instruction, as I mentioned, is halt. So anything with opcode 0 is going to stop the machine. So when our physical implementation of this, if we had one, reach that instruction or simulator, it's just going to sit powered out and say, I'm done, your program's finished. And note that we have this big unused portion here. And that's sort of because, well, we chose to have 16-bit instructions because we have instructions like load, where remember we wanted to put a big address in there. And some instructions don't need that, so we waste some space. And this is not something we're really concerned about because we want to keep our hardware simple. So next we have I/O. So everything with opcode 1 is some sort of I/O operation. And there are multiple kinds of I/O, and we've chosen to use two extra bits from the instruction to indicate what kind of I/O it is. So it will support multiple I/O operations, and we'll have these two extra bits, which happen to be bits 10 and 11, where, you know, numbered from least to low significant of the instruction. And all these I/O operations, because we have this one accumulator register, are going to go into or from the accumulator, because we don't have any other option, and we notice we didn't put an address in this instruction, so they're not going to go directly to or from memory, most likely. And we've chosen to provide three or four I/O operations. And this is probably the part where IBCM, as sort of a toy hardware, is maybe most unrealistic as far as hardware implementation, because you probably wouldn't actually want to implement read a hex word in hardware directly. You'd probably want to only implement read an ASCII character or something like that and have the program take care of it. But to make it possible for you to write programs that are like reasonable to use, we've provided these sort of fancy I/O operations. So we have read an hex word, hexadecimal word from input as operation 0. And I'm going to give a name to this, which in this case is readH. So these names I'm giving for the instructions are the names I'm going to use when I write assembly language. So IBCM doesn't really have an assembly language, and the reason why is we haven't written an assembler. So you're going to produce the machine code by hand, but I'm going to choose an assembly syntax and try to be consistent about this. And I would recommend you do that. So you write something which you could have an assembler for, and maybe if you want to do the labs that way, you can write your own assembler. But and so this is the name I will choose when I write assembly language examples. So we also have readC, which reads an ASCII character. So you might remember an ASCII character. Well, that's not 16 bits, so we're going to not use all the bits of the accumulator. And we also have print operations, and so on. So we also have this thing called shift operations. So there are four types of these, and they move bits in the accumulator around by a number of spaces specified by the count. So the count specifies a number of places to move. And these require some explanation. So say we have this accumulator value. So remember, our accumulator is a 16-bit register. So this is 16 bits it might contain. This is just a pattern of 0, 1, 4 zeros, 4 ones, 4 zeros, 4 ones. And we have four different what we call shift operations. You may note that my sort of English name for one of them is, this is the example. Results is, for two of them is shift, for the other two is rotate. So the shifts move the bits, and when we have extra spaces, we add zeros. So shift left, move the bits left, writing them in English order. And so we add these zeros in, and everything else goes over. And we move it by the count. So in this case, this is assuming the count is 3, meaning we put a 3 here, which means that we put a 1, 1, 0, 0, 0 in that part of the 16-bit value. And shift right means we're shifting in this direction. And we have rotate left and right. So rotate, instead of adding in zeros, we wrap around the values. So in this case, we had a bunch of zeros that got off the end here, and they ended up going to the back. And when we're rotating the other direction, we had a bunch of ones, which went off the right end and ended up going to the front.
So if the ones on the shift left, if the ones go off the end, it's still going to be zeros?
Yeah, so with shift left and shift right, we always add in zeros. We don't actually steal the values from the other side. But yes, if the values shifted over zeros, we get the same result, which is why there's some color coding on this slide. Other questions about these operations? So these are sorts of operations you'll commonly see implemented in real hardware, even though they're not something you commonly use in like a high-level programming language. And one reason is that they're really simple in hardware. Like, this is pretty easy to implement if you're dealing with binary numbers. And they are somewhat useful. Okay, so those are the basic operations. You note that I have this big old category labeled others, where we take some opcode, and we're going to use all the other opcodes, and we have an address. So all the other operations act on a value in memory, and generally they're going to have the form that they do something with a value in memory at the specified address and the accumulator, because we can't do something on two registers because we don't have two useful registers. So we have load and store. So basic, we have basic add access memory operations. We have add, subtract, and, or, XOR. So these are, and not, these are arithmetic and logical operations. I note that these logical operations are really sort of bitwise, though we probably won't end up using them. They work bit by bit, not on the whole value. So they take the bottom bit zero, the least significant bit, take the logical and of that, put it into bit zero, the result, bit one, and so on. We have one case where we don't use an address, or two actually. So one is not. We have a logical complement where we flip the bits. We don't use the address for that because, we only have the accumulator to flip. We don't need to max value in memory to flip bits. And we have a NOP, which stands for no operation, because sometimes you're going to want to have some filler in your assembly code. You want to have some space in memory where the machine's going to fetch instructions from there, but it won't do anything. That's an operation explicitly to let you do that. So you choose opcode B in hexadecimal, and that's not going to do anything. So we have these arithmetic operations, and we have these control operations. So we have jump. So if we didn't have jump, our processor would just keep executing one instruction after another until we got to the end of memory, in which case we'd add to the PC. It would wrap around. If you remember how addition and unsigned numbers works when we go to the maximum possible number, and we'd keep going around. And that's not very convenient because, your program has things like loops. So we need some way of implementing a loop. So our jump is our way of doing that. So this is our basic trivial implement flow control. And all it does is it stores a value in the PC, which we'll use instead of storing the address of the following memory location, adding one to the PC. So that's good for infinite loops. So if we have an infinite loop, we just put, say, go to the beginning of the loop, go to the beginning of the loop, but we actually want to say, go to the beginning of the loop, but not if you're done. So you want some way of doing that. So we have these conditional jumps. So these jumps which where we don't always jump. And we have two kinds. So one, I'm calling jump E, will jump, but only if the accumulator is zero. So we'll check if the accumulator is zero. If so, we'll set the PC to the address specified in this instruction. If not, we'll just keep going as if it was a no op. Just do nothing. And we also have jump L, which is if the value in the accumulator is negative, then we'll jump somewhere, otherwise we'll keep going. The naming of these you can think of as being based on comparing to zero. So jump if equal to zero, jump if less than zero. And we have this, finally, this very funny operation, BRL. What does that stand for? Which sets the accumulator to the address following the PC and jumps somewhere. So why would that operation be useful? Why would you want to store the PC plus one somewhere? Yeah. So yeah, so you say, is it like a return value? Yeah, so if we think of a function call, a method call, that's the next instruction after our call. So this could act like a call instruction. So, you know, our accumulator then becomes our return address. So this seems like a great way of implementing method calls, except how do we do the jump back to the address in the accumulator? Seems to be some missing pieces. And I don't think we actually have examples where we have you do function calls in IBCM. We'll do them in x86. But this is the kind of thing the hardware we implement to make function calls easier. Except we're missing the piece to go backwards where we use the accumulator to jump somewhere, because if you look at our jump instructions, none of them actually jump to a location specified by the accumulator. So you can do that in IBCM, and the way you do it is you write the machine code for a jump to the address in the accumulator by adding the opcode C to it, and then you execute that as an instruction, as your next instruction. But that's not very convenient. But that's sort of, but this instruction exists in order to provide something like method calls, even if it's not actually really successful. Okay, so any questions about these instructions? So, as I said, we don't have an assembler, but we're going to look at like what an assembly language looks like. So, we might have, let's say, load. So we have load, address, hex 100. So we have opcode 3, because we look up in that table, we look up the opcode, it's 3. And we have address, hex 100. So we convert that into machine code. And when we do that, we write the first 4 bits. The most significant 4 bits are the opcode. So this is opcode 3. And then we write our address out. And that's what the machine code looks like. So in memory, we're going to have this 16-bit value, and that's that load instruction. And typically, we're going to end up writing this in our input files for the simulator in hexadecimal, so we'll write something like 3100. For add, we have opcode 5, address 200, so we do encode 5, and then we have 200, So we write this as 5200. So yeah, add to address hex 200. And for jump B, similarly, we have some address. We encode that address as the bottom 12 bits. And we have D encoded in hexadecimal as our top. Or this ends up being D442 in hexadecimal. So when we're writing input for our simulator, we'll generally write it out as hexadecimal. It's really these binary bits. So here's, this is some assembly, and you can easily produce machine code from it. But while this assembly is very nice to translate to machine code, it's kind of actually inconvenient. So we have these hard-coded addresses here, and that's really annoying. Like, do I want to remember when I'm coding my assembly what's address hex 100 and what's address hex 200? Probably not. So we're going to have something called labels. So, you know, where previously we would say jump to address, you know, this would be 0, 1, 2, 3, let's say. We'd have to track that this is 0, 1, 2, 3 and say, okay, we have 3 here, that's going to go here. We have 0 here, that's going to go up there. That's kind of annoying to do. So we're going to have names for those locations. So we're going to say, I have a name, in this case, start, and that's where this jump goes. I have a name, end, and that's where this jump goes. So we're going to write, instead of writing assembly like this, where when we need names for locations in memory, we, you know, instead have to look up a number. We're going to have a name, we're going to mark the line with the name, and we're going to, as convention, put it before the instruction on that line. And we're going to call this name a label. So the label just is a representation of the memory address. So when we specify a label for an instruction, we're saying that address has this name. When we use a label in an instruction, like jump start or jump L end, we're saying, I want you to look up the address I labeled with this name and put it in that instruction. So when we use a real assembler, in which we don't have, but for x86 we will, we'll provide input kind of like this. And our assembler is going to go through the instructions in one pass and figure out where are all the labels. And it's going to make this mapping. It's going to say, okay, so start is at address 0 and end is at address 3. And then it's going to go through a second pass and it's going to fill in the labels when it's generating the machine code. So we can write this, and it's still pretty close to the machine code, and the assembler is still pretty easy to write. You know, assembler, now we have to do more work, but it's not like the compiler. We aren't making any choices. Like, we don't have multiple options for what things to generate, and there's no difficulty in understanding what the machine code will be. Like, you could do the translation by hand if you needed. And you can control what that's going to end up being by just choosing where you put your labels. So, questions about this? Yeah?
So start and end store the address of the instruction?
So start and end are the address. So our jump instruction needs to contain the address that, yeah, the PC will be set to. So it's an instruction address. So the question is, can you make a label that refers to an address, and the that refers to an address that contains no instructions?
Right.
And the answer is yes, and we'll get to that in a second when we talk about specifying data in general. So one thing that you notice we're missing is that, let's say I want to put the number 1 in my program. Like, that seems like a useful value to have in memory somewhere. Like, for example, here, I wrote add 100. That doesn't add the value 100. That reads memory address 100 and adds whatever's there. That's probably not what we want to do. You really want to add some like constant, like one. But to do that, we need to put one in memory somewhere. So we're going to talk about how do we write down, I want to put this value, which is an instruction, somewhere in memory. And when we do that, we'll talk about how we give a name to that address. Okay, so our labels replaced by memory addresses. So not everything in assembly is going to be instructions. So we mentioned that one use case where I want a constant, and I want a name for the constant, I want to write down the constant. For example, I don't want to add address 100, I want to have a name for a value I want to add. So assemblers have things we'll call directives. So directives are things that the assembler understands that aren't actual instructions. And the assembler processes them and does something with them when it produces the output. So one example that we're going to use for our toy IBCM assembly is DW for define word. And this is going to be like a pseudo instruction. We're going to write it where we'd write an instruction, but instead of specifying an instruction, we're just saying, I want this value here. This isn't an instruction, this is just a value, put it here. So for example, if we write IDW75, like if we wrote, you know, and NOP, you know, we're saying that we have something named I, but it's define word 75. So this is going to put the value 75, and we have a label for that value now, which is I. And this is going to give us a natural way of implementing addresses, or sorry, implementing variables. We're going to have a variable. We're going to, you know, I sounds like a variable name. That's chosen deliberately because this is how we might initialize a variable. We'll specify a memory location for it, and then we'll access it repeatedly. So for example, if we want to actually do something useful in our loop, and probably I should have put, it occurs to me that this is not where I wanted that loop label. I wanted it here. So if we put our loop label, so this isn't an infinite loop, and we don't keep loading 100 and then checking whether it's less than 0, but we actually jump up to the loop location, we load 100, we check if it's less than 0, it's not. We print it, we subtract 1, we go up to hopefully here and not loading 100 again, and print it again until we halt. And here we have constants because we need 1, we need to subtract 1, and if I wrote sub 1, well, what I'd actually be subtracting is address 1, which is, this is 0, 1, 2, this jump out instruction, whatever that turns out being as machine code. But I actually want to subtract the value 1, so I have a memory location here, which is probably going to be not 1, but something higher, that contains the value constant 1. So I load that constant 1 with the subtract instruction and have it be subtracted from the accumulator. And I also have my initial value of 100. I want to load that somewhere, so I have a place where I can load 100 in my code. Load the constant 100 because, you know, I need about that value somewhere in my program, so this is a way of me getting it and having a name for it where I don't need to figure out what memory address did I put that at. Does this make sense? And I'm sorry for bugs in slides. And this is also what we'll use for variables. So if you want a variable, let's say you want to do I plus equals j, well, we can have a label where we say, this is where we're storing I, this is where we're storing J. We load I into the accumulator, we add J to it, then we store it back to I, and that does I plus equals J. Okay, so any questions about this? Okay, so we'll talk, I guess we'll start talking about this. So we've talked about basic sort of what our assembly looks like, so now let's talk about going from one to the other. So let's say we have a bunch of instructions. What should my first step be in figuring out, you know, this is a bunch of memory, what should my first step be in figuring out how does this actually translate?
The opcode.
So where's the opcode?
The rightmost bit.
Yeah, so the opcode is the rightmost 4 bits. So this is here. Is the opcode. And we know we can look up the table, what it is, and that's going to give us our first notion of what happens. And we know that there's some arguments, so our next step is going to be to figure out the rest, and we'll get to that next time.